Previously on The Accidental Terrorist. The year is 1986. Our hero, Elder Bill Shun, an outwardly devout 19-year-old from Utah, has been called to serve 2 years as a missionary in the wild and foreign land of Alberta, Canada. Having been out in the field for less than 3 months, he is blissfully unaware of the arrest for terrorist-related activities that looms on his ever-nearer horizon. His senior companion, Elder Deadman, a lackadaisical missionary with the work ethic of a stoned ground sloth, has been leading them through a steady course of bowling, video games, and eight ball, and the increasingly depressed Bill, pining away for his older fiancée, Katrina, has made a grim confession to President Tuttle in an attempt to get sent home early from his mission, which of course it didn't accomplish. But as Christmas dawns, the right suggestion in the wrong ear may just get that ball rolling in a completely unexpected direction. The Accidental Terrorist, a memoir by William Shun. Chapter 14, The Tissue at Hand. I rose early the next day, after a fitful sleep. In the one dream I could remember, Elder Deadman carved chunks of deer meat from those severed haunches in the Badlands and offered them to me to eat. The sight of the Christmas tree did nothing to improve my disconsolate mood. We had mounted it on the kitchen table the night before and decorated it with Jiffy Pop popcorn strung on thread. The effect was pathetic. I tried not to look at it as I made myself breakfast. Elder Deadman slept late, and I finally shook him awake around 11. I packed my overnight bag while he took a shower, and shortly before noon we set out for our zone conference in Lethbridge. A flippin' waste of a P-Day, as Deadman put it. Lethbridge is a beautiful, open, green city, built on the banks of the Oldman River in southern Alberta, and home to one of the longest railway trestle bridges in the world. The warm Chinook winds that moderate its winters weren't in evidence. After 2 hours driving under gray skies, we pulled into the parking lot of a large Mormon meeting house near the University of Lethbridge, joining a small fleet of Cavaliers, Citations, and Aries K's. Laughing elders milled about in the halls of the church, and a spirited volleyball match was underway in the streamer-bedecked cultural hall. Nearly 3 dozen missionaries showed up in all, and we played games and ate food provided by the local relief society all afternoon. I spent time catching up with both Elder Pugh and Elder Hendricks from my MTC district, and I also chatted briefly with Elder Gass, our strutting, newly-fledged zone leader. It was nice to see everyone, and to have more than just Elder Deadman around for company. But on another level, all the activity around me made me feel even more lonely than I had before. I had a few friends here, yes, but no one who shared my oddball sense of humor. No confidant. The missionary I most wanted to see was Elder Vickers, 1,000 miles north in Yellowknife. "You want to see my what?" said Elder Vickers, assuming that expression of shock and disgust he feigned so well. "Your tonsils," I said. "Come on, Vickers, I know you keep them in your closet." It was our second full week at the MTC. I had accompanied Vickers on his daily trip to the main building for our mail. As district leader, he had the only key to the box, and he'd been sorting through the day's haul as we walked. He was a short, barrel-chested young man with freckles, ruddy cheeks, and a crown of unruly blonde curls that would have made Norman Rockwell weep. "What gave you such a ridiculous idea?" he said. From the sharpness in his speeded-up drawl, I almost expected him to add, "Soldier!" I gave him a sly grin. "Munoz told me." Elder Munoz was one of Vickers' roommates. Vickers harumphed. "He has said this to deceive you, and I would advise you to get out of his employ." I laughed. The rest of our district seemed to resent Vickers as a drill sergeant with a willfully inflexible stick up his ass. I liked the irreverent humor he dropped into his remarks, though, and when I returned it in kind, we'd begun to bond. To us, the pinnacle of drollery was to lard our speech with out-of-context phrases from the temple endowment ceremony, in which we participated once or twice a week as part of the MTC routine. The ceremony, which we attended across the street at the Provo Temple, took the form of an anachronistic mystery play depicting the creation of the earth and the fall of man. Vickers's line was one the Apostle Peter delivered to a Protestant minister who had been preaching false doctrines he learned from Lucifer. "No, seriously, Elder," I said. "Come on." Elder Vickers sighed. "Yes, I keep my tonsils in a jar in my closet." "Wow, why?" "I don't know, really," he said, shrugging. "When I had my tonsillectomy, the doctor asked me if I wanted to keep them, and I said yes. That was years ago. I've had that same jar all this time." "Can I see them?" He looked at me coldly. "We do not satisfy men's curiosity in that manner." This was Peter's rebuke to the minister when he asked for a sign that Peter was a true messenger from God. "We commend you for your integrity," I said, like Peter to Adam when he refuses to trade what is sacred for money. "But what's it going to hurt?" I asked. "Elder Munoz saw them." Vickers sighed. "I see that this must be so." Eve to Lucifer, when presented with the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. "All right, then. Come on." It was later that week that I happened to fall in step with an elder named Preston as I walked from the cafeteria back to the dorm after lunch. Preston's district shared our dormitory. They were a week younger than we, but far more unruly. After our district had played a very mild practical joke on them on their first night at the MTC, they had retaliated against us with a full-bore water assault. Preston was the worst of the lot, a tall, porcine, marshmallowy elder with a nasty laugh and a mean streak a mile wide. Preston and I chatted amiably beneath the brilliant blue sky as we walked. He seemed a nice enough fellow, one-on-one, if a little quick to take offense at innocent statements. Entering our dorm, Preston turned his moon-like face to me and asked, "What's the deal with that Elder Vickers, anyway? He just won't let up. Why is he such a hard-ass?" I almost broke out in a grin. I saw right off what I had to do. My enemy had unwittingly delivered himself into my hands. Silently, I thanked God for this marvelous gift. I almost felt bad for what I was about to do, but not quite. I clapped Preston heartily on the shoulder. His white shirt jiggled. "I know he can be a real pain, Elder," I said, "but you have to cut Vickers some slack. He's been through some traumatic experiences in his day, and they're not the kind of thing you just walk away from smiling."
"Oh yeah?" said Preston, squinting. "Like what?"
I furrowed my brow. I don't know if I should really be telling you about it. I mean, anything that leaves you less a man than you were before, well, that's pretty personal stuff. If Elder Vickers ever found out I said anything, my ass would be grass." Preston raised his arm to the square.
"Oh, I'll never tell. Scout's honor."
"Swear on your life?"
"Swear."
I thought a moment, then nodded. "Okay, here it is." We had reached the bottom of the stairs, and I held the handle of the door to our corridor without opening it. I lowered my voice, forcing Preston to lean in close. "When Elder Vickers was 17, they diagnosed him with testicular cancer." Preston's eyes grew satisfyingly wide.
"You mean his balls? He got ball cancer?"
"Shh, keep it down," I said. "Yes, he got cancer of the balls. They tried treating him all kinds of different ways, chemicals, radiation, what have you, but none of it worked. The cancer kept growing, and it spread from one testicle to the other." Preston shook his head.
"Oh, man."
"Yeah. Finally, there was nothing else the doctors could do. They said the testicles had to come out."
"No way!"
"Yep. So Elder Vickers goes under the knife, and when he wakes up again, voila, no more cancer. But no more balls, either." My whopping friend took a deep breath.
"Oh, my heck!"
You got that right. It's a miracle Elder Vickers is here on a mission today, but he's still just learning to deal with the fact that he's never going to have some of the experiences the rest of us take for granted, like having children of his own. Never gonna happen.
Oh man, that's a rotten deal,
said Preston, chewing the inside of his cheek. Yeah, so when he starts giving you a hard time, just understand that he's not really mad at you at all. He's just... A spitish light dawned in Elder Preston's eyes.
Hey, wait a minute. You're friends with Elder Vickers. How do I know you're telling the truth?
I shrugged. I can prove it, I said. He squinted.
You're not going to try to get me to feel his nads or anything, are you? Because I'm not going to do that.
No, nothing like that, I said. I'll show you his testicles. Come on. I opened the door from the stairwell.
Wait,
said Preston, grabbing my arm with a clammy hand.
You'll what?
I'll show you his testicles. When he just kept staring at me, I sighed and shut the door again. Look, he was pretty attached to his nuts. When the operation was over, he asked if he could keep them. So the doctors put them in formaldehyde and gave him the jar. He keeps it with him wherever he goes.
You're lying!
I am not. The jar is on a shelf in his closet. Come on, I'll show you. As I led the somewhat reluctant Elder Preston down the hall, we ran into Elder Munoz. Hey, I said, is anyone in your room?
No, I just left, said Munoz. No one's there.
Could you let us in? I asked, winking so only Munoz could see. I gotta show Vickers's testicles to Elder Preston.
Oh, yeah, those. He nodded, smiling faintly.
Sure, no problem. Munoz opened his room for us and stood aside. Just be sure it's locked when you leave. Enjoy the show. I flipped on the lights, then positioned Elder Preston in front of Elder Vickers' closet.
You know, Sean, he said, I really do believe you.
Tiny pearls of sweat stood out on his forehead.
You don't have to...
Don't be a pussy, Elder. Think of what Vickers went through. The least you can do is stand there for 10 seconds and look at what he faces every day of his life. I grasped the handle of the closet and slowly, ever so slowly, eased open the door. The crack of light falling inside widened, curving against the glass surface of a regular mason jar at about chest level. A yellowish fluid filled the jar, and suspended in the fluid like a pair of blind eyes were two lumps of gray tissue, each about the size of a strawberry. Obscene and phlegmy, the tonsils stared out of the closet with mute reproach, devoid of any power but the power to shock, the power to silence. I looked at Elder Preston. I watched the blood drain from his face. I watched him open his mouth to speak. A fat, wet hole appearing in a face as gray as Elder Vickers's tonsils, making no sound. He pointed at the jar, and slowly his face turned toward me.
That,
he said.
That.
Laughter bubbled up inside me like oil from a highly pressurized deposit far underground. The look on Preston's face had sunk the well, and now I feared that if I opened my mouth, I'd release a gusher. As promised, I said, bowing my head and covering my mouth, but the damage was already done. I wish I could say I kept a straight face, but I didn't. Giggles shook my chest like a California earthquake, and my knees buckled under the recoil of an explosive guffaw. Preston stared at me, then back at the jar, then back at me again.
Hey, wait a second,
he said, his face turning a mottled red.
Those aren't his balls!
Sliding down the wall to the floor, I barely managed to squeak out the word, tonsils, between shuddering breaths and debilitating laughter. Elder Preston clenched his fists and stomped out of the room like the Incredible Hulk leaving the scene of his latest misadventure. When I could finally breathe again, I hauled myself up to my feet and locked the door behind me, happier than I'd felt since coming to the MTC. Revenge is so sweet, if they'd included it on the dessert table in the cafeteria, they could never have kept enough on hand to satisfy the demand. I sat fidgeting in an upholstered folding chair outside the Lethbridge State President's office. Indistinct murmurs came from within, while sickly white fluorescent light flickered overhead. The four other elders in our district had taken their turns already, and now they were back in the cultural hall with the rest of the zone, no doubt noshing on cookies and hot apple cider and having a fine time of it all. I wished my interview with Prez were over and I were there too. At last the door opened and Elder Deadman emerged with President Tuttle's avuncular hand on his shoulder. "You keep up the good work, Elder," said Prez. "There's gold in Brooks yet, and I know you can dig it up. And don't forget to get a little more off around the ears next time. You're starting to look like a mop." Deadman tossed me a quick wink before heading back out to his volleyball match. Apparently he hadn't unburdened himself of any damning secrets in his worthiness interview that might trip me up during mine. Not that I'd expected he would, but it would have been so much easier if I could have gone in with our sins already exposed and not suffer the dilemma of whether to fess up or keep quiet. "Elder Shun," said President Tuttle, motioning me into the office, "good to see you. Come right in, please." Besides the camaraderie and the inspirational meetings and the opportunity for instruction by our leaders, these interviews were one of the primary purposes of a zone conference, a periodic check of the spiritual oil by a factory-trained mechanic. Prez settled himself behind the stake president's desk like some jovial business world Buddha, and after a brief prayer and a few opening pleasantries, he plied me with the same familiar questions I'd been asked in priesthood interviews by bishops and stake presidents since the beginning of time. Did I have a testimony of Jesus Christ and Joseph Smith? Did I pray regularly and sincerely? Did I refrain from using alcohol and tobacco? I fielded these questions honestly, if glibly, but when he started digging into my performance as a missionary, I felt myself on less certain ground. Still, while I hinted that my proselytizing habits could stand some improvement, I came nowhere close to spilling the awful truth about what we were really accomplishing in Brooks. After what for me were 10 grueling minutes of interrogation, prosecutable under the Geneva Convention, President Tuttle came to the end of his scripted questions. He leaned forward in his chair, clasped his hands on the desk, chewed the inside of his cheek. "Elder Shun," he said, his voice gravid with concern, "how are you really? What's wrong?" I froze, a sudden liquid pressure heating the backs of my eyes, frightened and awed by the acuity of Tuttle's powers of spiritual discernment. Here was my opportunity to unload, to come clean, to shed the terrible voltage of guilt that charged every moment of every day. Here was my chance not just to set things right in Brooks, but to stand up and deliver myself of the bravest confession of my life, the confession that I hated my mission and I wanted to leave. Here was my chance to put all this craziness behind me and get on with my life, my normal, everyday life back home in Utah. The window shades were only half drawn, and the overhead fluorescence clashed with the premature twilight. I hesitated somewhat in my response, and in so hesitating, I no doubt prompted President Tuttle to extend the branch that seemed for one shining moment to offer a quick shortcut to my goal. He took in my reluctance to answer, and, donning the most sympathetic expression in his bag, asked with earnest, probing care, "Elder Shun, are you having a problem with masturbation?" At once, I felt such a weight lifted from my shoulders that I could have jumped up and cracked my head open on the ceiling. Indeed, there were several mornings when I'd awakened from dimly recalled exertions to discover the aftermath of wet dreams. Here was my way out. By confessing to masturbation, I could deflect suspicion of any other malfeasance while still copping to a sexual transgression that must surely be serious enough to get me sent home. Hallelujah! So I lowered my head meekly, and in a small voice, admitted my unnatural crimes, and watched from one eye while my president shook his head sadly and reached into his briefcase for the paperwork that would set my court-martial and eventual discharge into motion. "I'm very sorry to hear that, Elder Shun," he said, tapping the sheaf of papers in his hand against the desktop. "It's an insidious habit, and it must have been weighing you down horribly." "Yes," I agreed, biting my lips to keep the appropriate expression of remorse from fleeing my face. "I'm sure you feel like an irredeemable wretch right now," said Prez. "But that's just what Satan wants. This is probably the most common confession we hear as mission presidents, and it's because it's an unfortunately easy way for him to get to young missionaries and kill their effectiveness." He passed the stapled papers across the desk to me. "But the good news is, it's a habit you can fight, and a habit you can break. That right there is a guide from Elder Peterson, the Apostle, with plenty of suggestions for how you can overcome the temptation to masturbate. It won't be easy, but I know you're strong, Elder Shun, and I know you can do it. Just remember to pray, and never lose faith." I flipped through the grainy typescript, an nth-generation photocopy, with a sinking heart. "Steps to Overcoming Masturbation," proclaimed the title, and the attribution was an apostle named Mark E. Peterson. I caught a few of the tips as I scanned through it. Avoid spicy food. Don't drink water before retiring. Wear bulky clothing to bed instead of pajamas. Sleep with a Book of Mormon clutched in your hands. Aghast, I looked up again, and Touche offered me an encouraging smile. "Don't worry, Elder," he said. "I know right now it may seem like the end of the world, but you're not finished as a missionary, I promise you that. Not by a long shot, you're not."
Chapter 15.
Profit Sharing. If I felt humiliated by the confession elicited by President Tuttle, at least I could look to the example of another Latter-day Saint who struggled with keeping his appetites within appropriate bounds. Brigham Young may have been the most famous Mormon polygamist, but the first was Joseph Smith himself. Critics sometimes charged that Joseph concocted the whole plural marriage scheme to cover up and sanctify marital infidelities. But if so, he did some very careful advance planning. The first hint of his unconventional philosophies to come can be found in the Book of Mormon, in a sermon delivered by the prophet Jacob to the people of Nephi,
which Joseph wrote, or translated if you prefer, in 1829. "They understand not the scriptures, for they seek to excuse themselves in committing whoredoms because of the things which were written concerning David and Solomon his son. Behold, David and Solomon truly had many wives and concubines, which thing was abominable before me, saith the Lord. Wherefore, my brethren, hear me, and hearken to the word of the Lord. For there shall not any man among you have, save it be one wife, and concubines he shall have none. For if I will, saith the Lord of hosts, raise up seed unto me, I will command my people. Otherwise, they shall hearken unto these things." Jacob, chapter 2, verses 23, 24, 27, and 30, the Book of Mormon. Even this early in his prophetic career, the scriptures Joseph brought forth were attempting a reconciliation between problematic aspects of the Old Testament and the conventional Christian morality of the day.
Evidence suggests that Joseph's first explicit revelation on the subject of plural marriage, what the rest of the world refers to as polygamy, came as early as 1831. But even so, it's important to realize that his marital innovations were hardly unique. Other religious communities in the Northeast, including the Perfectionist and the Swedenborgians, experimented with non-standard sexual mores during roughly the same period. But Joseph's teachings were destined to overshadow and by far outlive the others, both in actual implementation and in the country's thrilled and horrified popular imagination. Joseph had married Emma Hale in 1827, and commencing in 1830, he may secretly have entreated girls as young as 12 to become his spiritual wives. But it wasn't until 1833 that his first well-documented plural marriage took place, when he wed Fanny Alger, a 16-year-old girl working as a maid in the house where he lived with Emma and their children in Kirtland, Ohio. Joseph's clandestine proposal may have been relayed to Fanny by her uncle, Levi Hancock, who is also held to have performed the ceremony at the prophet's behest. Though Emma knew nothing of this second marriage, she suspected a relationship between Fanny and her husband and threw the girl out of the house not long after the wedding. Fanny may possibly have been pregnant with Joseph's child at the time. Joseph's next generally accepted marriage took place in 1838 to Lucinda Pendleton Morgan Harris, widow of the martyr William Morgan, the very man killed in 1826 for having written his famous expose of Masonry. Lucinda was Joseph's first verifiable polyandrous wife. She was already married to minor Mormon leader George Washington Harris when she wed Joseph. This pattern would repeat itself many times over the next several years, as nearly a dozen of the at least 33 women Joseph wed polygynously were already married. Some had converted to Mormonism and moved west without divorcing their husbands, but others, like Marinda Nancy Johnson Hyde, were wives of other prominent church leaders. Marinda, in fact, married Joseph while her husband, Apostle Orson Hyde, was serving a mission for the church in Palestine. Joseph also married the young daughters of many of his closest associates, and you are entirely justified in wondering what led these men to put up with their prophet's shenanigans. Around this same period, Joseph was also developing his doctrine of celestial marriage, which states that men and women who are sealed together by priesthood authority on earth will remain married eternally in heaven. His lieutenants may have permitted, or rather not opposed, Joseph's celestial marriages to their wives and daughters in order to ensure the proximity of their own links to his in the great dynastic chain he was forging for the life to come. These were magnanimous gestures on the parts of his followers, though heartbreaking when you realize that because women were allowed to marry only one husband eternally, these men were in effect sacrificing their own celestial marriages with their first and presumably most beloved wives for the sake of the prophet. Joseph, for his part, may also have been testing the loyalty and obedience of his closest counselors. Tradition holds that an agonized Parley Pratt, one of Joseph's apostles, consented to let the prophet wed his cherished wife Mary Ann, only to have Joseph let him off the hook at the last second, like God granting Abraham a reprieve from sacrificing his son Isaac. Their faithfulness proven, Joseph told the relieved Pratts that they were blessed for their obedience, but that the sacrifice would not be required of them after all. As Joseph's plural marriages proliferated, so did the rumors flying around Nauvoo of his sexual malfeasance. Only those who had to know were taught the principle of plural marriage, and Joseph publicly denied the rumors of its practice time and again. Not even Emma knew the truth of the matter, though she certainly suspected Joseph of continual infidelity. The situation at home came to a head when Eliza R. Snow, Joseph's 14th or so plural wife, came to live and work as a teacher in the Smiths' home. In February 1843, Emma's jealousy of Eliza reached such a pitch that she angrily tossed the other woman out of the house and into the night. One account claims that Emma actually kicked Eliza down the stairs, causing the younger wife to miscarry Joseph's child. Many of Joseph's lieutenants were now living in polygamy as well, making it harder and harder to keep the practice hidden. Joseph was finally forced to let Emma in on the secret, lest she murder his suspected mistresses. She didn't take the news well, but did assume responsibility for selecting Joseph's wives from then on. Evidently, Joseph hadn't told her the whole truth, however, because the first girls Emma chose for him to marry, sisters barely out of their teens, named Emily and Eliza Partridge, were already his plural wives. Joseph staged a second wedding ceremony with the sisters so Emma wouldn't feel more angry and humiliated than she did already, after which the girls moved into the house. Another sister pair selected by Emma, the teenaged Sarah and Maria Lawrence, soon joined them. Emma never embraced the practice of polygamy, however, and found the necessity of living under the same roof with other wives nearly intolerable. Joseph's polyandrous wives, for the most part, lived with their original husbands, and many others boarded with families privy to the secret. She begged Joseph so fervently to disavow the principle, either that or permit her to take spiritual husbands to assuage her horrid loneliness, that when he finally issued a revelation from God legitimizing plural marriage, it contained a side note to Emma, telling her, in so many words, that if she didn't shut up and get with the program, she would be destroyed. Emma really didn't take that well. Later, after Joseph's death, she repudiated polygamy entirely, going so far as to deny that Joseph had ever had any wife but her. She stayed behind when his successor, Brigham Young, led the Great Exodus to the Salt Lake Valley, and her son eventually became president of the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The sect, headquartered in Missouri, now called simply the Community of Christ, claims prophetic succession can pass only from father to son.
This may in fact have been Joseph's original intent, but he didn't live long enough to settle that question. Next time on The Accidental Terrorist. In our next installment, an impromptu Christmas phone call shows Elder Shun an unexpected way out of his missionary dilemma. But will Elder Deadman screw up Bill's plans like he does with everything else? Stealthy schemes, emotional confrontations, hair-raising escapes, and what about Bob? The pacemaker-damaging suspense is all here.
Just 1 week from now!
The Accidental Terrorist. Spoken material, copyright 2006-2009 by William Shun. All rights reserved. For more readings by William Shun, please visit shun.net/podcast or search for William Shun, S-H-U-N-N, in the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.